This is The Guardian.
I think it shows that we don't take ourselves so seriously. We take the voters' concerns seriously.
If Lady Starmer was going out looking like a sack of spuds, there'd be complaints about that.
But let me say this clearly and unequivocally. Nigel Farage isn't a friend of the working class. He's a fraud.
Don't look back in anger. I'm afraid we do look back in anger at what the last government left to this government.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian.
Hi Pippa, you're in Brighton right now, right?
I am. I'm actually sitting in my hotel room looking out over a beautiful sunny morning, and the sea is sparkling in the distance. Don't suppose I'll have time for a swim later because I'm here for Lib Dem conference.
I think you have plenty of time for a swim then. How is it? What's the mood like down there? Are they completely cock-a-hoop?
Yeah, actually, one senior Lib Dem said to me earlier today that that this conference actually was a celebration and a big party. A party with a small p, you know, of the sort that you have a drink and a dance, because, of course, they went from 15 MPs to 72 at the election, which is a massive increase. And despite their rather controversial electoral strategy, which we'll come on to later, it actually played off. And this is very much in good spirits and looking forward to being back at Westminster and, being an effective third party.
Well, as you say, we'll talk about that in a second. But actually, the big story of the day is nowhere near Brighton. The front pages, unsurprisingly, are dominated by news out of the US where a second person has been arrested for an attempted assassination attempt against Donald Trump. I say, second person within just a few weeks. It seems quite extraordinary that this could happen again. But, one of the things I remember from being out in the US reporting on politics is that the levels of security that a candidate gets is quite different from what an actual president gets. So if it was Joe Biden out playing golf, he probably wouldn't be on that course. And if he was on that course, you'd have had, Secret Service agents all around the perimeter. But at least on this occasion, unlike the last one, the Secret Service agents do seem to have stopped it in its tracks and found the guy before anything happened.
Yeah, but there's still big questions about the security of the former president, isn't there? Because this is, of course, as you say, the second time that this has happened in recent weeks. And as a result of that first assassination attempt, the Secret Service chief, Kimberly Cheetle, had to resign. And they stepped up security around Trump as a result of it. So it's kind of like, doubly bad. But then, of course, it's not just about the security impact. There is, of course, the broader political impact and the fact that after the last attempt, Trump's ratings spiked, whether it's out of sympathy, whether it's out of support for him sort of under fire, literally, it's not clear. But at that point, Biden was still the likely Democrat candidate, and now it's Kamala Harris. So it'd be interesting to see, while condemning political violence in the sort of immediate aftermath of this incident, it will be interesting to see how it plays out slightly longer term with the electorate and how she deals with the challenge of that.
Yeah, and there's always a scramble, isn't there, to try and figure out the politics of the person who actually tried to carry out the attack. I'm never sure how illuminating it is. I mean, this particular person seems to have voted Republican in 2016, but then undergone something of a change of heart, became a very vociferous activist in favor of Ukraine and in favor of having more foreign troops helping out the Ukrainian army. There was a really interesting interview with him done several years ago by Semaphore, the website Semaphore. Just by chance, they happened to have interviewed him, and then they wrote about it again today, just looking back at that interview. And I think they described him as a bit over the top, and even other people in Ukraine felt that. So, no matter what political causes this guy espoused, I think, fundamentally, somebody who tries something at this, obviously, there's a lot of other things that are wrong. I'm always slightly sceptical of this idea of, well, if we can just figure out what their politics were, that will tell us something important. Not sure it ever does.
Inevitably, people will attempt to do that. So we'll see how that all plays out in the US election race, which obviously we're now only a few weeks, just over a month to go until polling day in the States. And so lots of our focus, both as journalists, but also obviously the government, will be on what's happening on the other side of the Atlantic. But for now, Keir Starmer, having himself been over in Washington on Friday, meeting Joe Biden for what was described as a policy deep dive on issues like Ukraine and the Middle East. He was there with the US president for a couple of hours. He has continued his global tour, and he is currently in Rome meeting the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni. Top of the agenda in the discussion there will be irregular migration, and specifically how Italy has managed to see a 60% drop in irregular migration by sea, by small boats, in the last year. This, of course, is a big political issue back home as well. And what Italy has done was a few things. It has reached financial settlements with a couple of countries, including Tunisia and Libya in North Africa, to try and stop people leaving those countries in the first place. A lot of migrants traveling through Africa will use those as a jumping off point to travel across the Mediterranean. And they also are in discussions, the Italians, with the Albanians about having a returns scheme there. David Lammy, the Foreign Secretary, over the weekend suggested that Britain might be interested in something similar. The big difference, obviously, between the Albania proposal and the Rwanda scheme, which was so criticised by Labour, the Rwanda scheme of the last government, is that migrants would be processed, would be taken from Britain and processed in Albania, and they could be returned to their country of origin. But they could also, if their scheme was successful, if their application was successful, could return to the UK and settle there as well. So Italy is currently setting up a scheme along those lines. And I think Britain's going to be very interested to see how that plays out for them, because migration remains a huge political issue for Labour.
It's extraordinary, isn't it, the hold that Giorgia Meloni has over British prime ministers. I remember when Rishi Sunak came to office, and I don't think I was the only one in thinking, well, these two are not going to have a particularly warm relationship. He seems like a kind of technocrat, almost more at home in the world of the Californian tech industry. And she's this tub-thumping populist right winger from Italy. And yet they struck up this very close relationship. He was always kind of going out to see her or vice versa, and they always met when there were international summits. Then Keir Starmer comes in, you think, well, this isn't going to go well. Again, you know, a Labour prime minister incoming. They've just scrapped the Rwanda scheme. And I remember they met during the European Political Community Summit at Blenheim Palace, and, you know, seemed to apparently have a very warm meeting there. And, you know, again, they're meeting this week. There's clearly something about what Italy's doing on immigration that the Brits are really interested in. And that's fine for Rishi Sunak, but that will be a much harder sell for Keir Starmer with his own party. And I think what he needs to do is stress the fact that, as you mentioned, unlike Rwanda, this would presumably involve successful applicants actually coming into this country rather than staying in the country they're being processed in. That seems to be the key difference.
Yeah, but inevitably there's been a pretty sort of immediate response from some Labour MPs, particularly some of those on the left, and some human rights groups and refugee groups here, who are suggesting that actually Meloni's approach to migration has been, you know, human rights have been secondary. I think Human Rights Watch described the Italians' Albanian plan as a model of mismanagement and a blueprint for abuse. And some Labour MPs are quite uncomfortable that Keir Starmer is on this sort of fact-finding mission, is trying to learn lessons from a government which, frankly, is neo-fascist, particularly when you see it in the context of some of the stuff that was going on in Britain over the summer with riots and some of the far-right racism that we saw back home. So I think quite a few Labour MPs would feel quite comfortable by seeing him, in their view, cozying up to Meloni, whereas Starmer and Downing Street see it very much as a useful exercise in seeing what works. And while they will obviously want to implement any British scheme in a way that meets the concerns of not only their own backbenchers, but the British public, it is absolutely undeniable that small boat crossings to Italy have fallen. So, you know, there might be some lessons, despite the fact that the government's right-wing populist, that they can take from that.
Yeah, well, you talk about, you know, the impact on human rights and the people actually making the crossings in the first place. In 2023, it was estimated that over 3,105 migrants died while crossing the Mediterranean. As of May 2024, so May of this year, that number was 800. So there are thousands of people dying. And now Giorgia Meloni's deputy prime minister is being accused of actually directly having a hand in turning boats away. And might come under investigation for that. So if more comes out about the direct involvement of her and her allies in directly being there, being responsible for boats being turned away and people dying as a result, then I think that will become very difficult as a model for the Brits to try and copy.
Yeah, but it is interesting, isn't it, how many European leaders are flocking to Italy to meet Meloni and are trying to build relationships with her, because of course she had electoral success as well. A lot of sort of centrist or centre-left European leaders are grappling with migration issues. We've seen it in Britain, we've seen it in France, we've seen it in Germany, and they will be wanting to look at all solutions, even if they don't end up implementing them or following what was really quite controversial and difficult options that the Italians are following on so many levels. But the personal relationship's really interesting as well, isn't it? I mean, you touched on it about talking about how her and Rishi Sunak seem to really like each other. Somebody in Downing Street was saying that her style in these meetings is to have an Aperol spritz in one hand and a cigarette in the other. And I just kind of think that the image of her and Keir Starmer in the room talking about issues like migration while that happens, it'll be interesting to see how that goes down. But it's not just about migration that they're going to be talking about. I mean, there are all sorts of international issues, not least Ukraine. And following on from the Prime Minister's visit to the White House on Friday, there's a bit of an outreach effort going on with other allies about whether the West should allow Storm Shadow long-range missiles to be used by Ukraine into Russia to sort of hit military targets. And that was very much sort of like the key, most immediate topic for discussion between Starmer and Biden and their teams. But it relies on the input and the support of international allies, not least those countries who have responsibility or whose components help make up the missiles themselves, as in the case of Italy, but also to have that buy-in from other big European powers beyond Britain and beyond those on the eastern fringes of Europe. So it's not just about migration in this trip. It's also about holding talks about Ukraine and also the economy, because Italy is of course a G7 member and one of the biggest economies in Europe. So there'll be lots for them to chew over in this brief visit to Rome.
So while Keir Starmer is in Rome, you're in the equally glamorous seaside location of Brighton, where you say the mood is good. These always used to be my favourite party conferences, actually, Lib Dem conferences, because you don't get completely swamped with hangers-on and lobbyists and people trying to bend your ear over things that are not necessarily directly related to politics. You get decent access to very senior politicians, and they're often a bit more relaxed than Labour or Tory conferences, I found. But is that the case this year?
Yeah, absolutely. And they're seeing it very much as a sort of an opportunity to kind of celebrate the successes of the election campaign for them. They went from 15 seats to 72, the biggest that the Lib Dem parliamentary party has ever been. While they're sort of celebrating how it's gone so far, they're also looking at how they can use that, how they can wield that influence in parliament. But we were still treated to the arrival of Ed Davey on Saturday, as has become sort of, a fairly sort of common expectations for the Lib Dem leader, arriving on a jet ski, another stunt. Lib Dem leader Ed Davey became known for his stunts during the election campaign. And of course, it would have been rude, really, to start off this conference without one. So he arrived on the Brighton shore on a jet ski and in, obviously, a wetsuit, which has become sort of common apparel, I think, for him over the last few months. And so began this conference with a stunt, which has prompted lots of discussion here in the bars and in the conference centre about whether the stunts were actually a good thing or not. What's your take, Kieran? Do you think that Ed Davey's willingness to throw himself off bungee jumps and round roller coasters and falling off paddle boards into potentially sewage full waters was good for them at the election or a distraction?
I mean, it was undeniably good for them. I think, it brought them absolutely vital coverage. But more than anything, I think it really helped detoxify the brand, because For years, particularly voters on the left and the centre-left have hated the Lib Dems for going into coalition with the Tories and never really warmed to Nick Clegg, and certainly not after the election. And I think Ed Davey really helped, you know, with his stunts just take some of the heat out of that relationship. But, by the way, I have loved the coverage of Ed Davey, quote unquote, arriving on a jet ski, as if he set off from London on a jet ski, went down the Thames, went round the coast.
You're telling me he didn't? That's what I thought had happened. 3 days later, he arrives in Brighton.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Very sunburnt.
But there is a really serious point to this, isn't it? I mean, you mentioned that they ended up getting tons of coverage. Well, what senior strategists here tell us is that normally what happens for Lib Dem leaders is that they get their sort of their brief interview on the Today programme, or, you know, their interview with The Guardian or whoever else during the election campaign. And the journalists, the broadcasters, ask them questions about Labour or Tory policies. Or at the very most, they basically say to them, you know, why are the Lib Dems rubbish and not having an impact, and, you know, is not really sort of very positive for them. But what this did is it created a space, because the first question was always, why are you doing this stunt? And then they would be able to explain, well, precisely because it, you know, it gets attention. And one example that was given was to us, which I thought was really interesting, was that some Lib Dem MPs were getting a bit anxious about, you know, Ed Davey's fifth, you know, whether it was a water slide or paddleboard or whatever, kayak. And had started complaining and saying they weren't going to go out and defend the stunts publicly. And then came the bungee stunt. And within seconds of Ed Davey jumping off that bungee platform, the pictures were the main item on the BBC website. They were right across the broadcast media. And sort of, you know, Keir Starmer, whatever worthy speech he was given that day, was relegated right to the bottom. And it bought them the sort of coverage and airtime that they just wouldn't have otherwise have got. And the other aspect to it, which I guess is similar to your sort of, you know, suggestion that it helps detoxify the party, was that it showed the human side of him and the fun side of him. Yeah. And at a time when actually attitudes towards politicians were pretty low and pretty pessimistic, it sort of, particularly with younger and middle-aged voters, it sort of, you know, got them a bit more engaged. It showed us, you know, the human side of him. And then that the stunts combined with their party political broadcast, which was about Ed Davey's personal story, the fact that he'd had to deal with quite a lot of hardship growing up, the fact that he was a carer himself now for his son, showed sort of the more sort of serious side to him. And that the combination of those two things actually, they think, you know, raised his profile, gave the party a chance to get an airing, and really helped with the sort of, you know, the increase in the seats that they managed to achieve.
I think the problem they're going to have is trying to figure out what kind of party they want to be. And I've still not got a sense of who the Lib Dems want to be. Do they still want to be the party of Nick Clegg, of socially liberal but economically conservative? If the Tories had a socially liberal wing, it would be that. Or are they going to go back further in time and be what the Lib Dems were for years under Labour government, which was the party to the left of Labour, picking off votes and picking off support where Labour was ditching them on issues like Iraq? And at the moment, what they are is probably a two or three issue party. So whether that's on the NHS and carers in particular, or on sewage, and that's fine. They can make their names on those issues. But I don't have a sense of what ties those issues together. What is, you know, what is the thinking here? Why this issue? Why that issue? What is the place of the Lib Dems in that? And I imagine part of that will come out during the course of this parliament. But I also imagine the Lib Dems are often accused of being opportunistic. Maybe that's unfair. All politicians are opportunistic. But certainly they're able to change into whatever kind of party that they want to be, depending on the political circumstances around them. And I suspect they're going to do the same this time.
Well, the senior Lib Dems we've spoken to here very much say that they are happy with being an issues party, that as a third party, but a third party that is actually only about 50 seats short of the second party, the Tories, they have the opportunity to pick a couple of issues and really drive change. And the two that they've picked, as we know, are sewage and care. And they think the care in particular, social care, if they can hold Labour's feet to the fire over it and make sure it's not an issue which is kicked into the long grass of the second term. Labour promised, obviously, to set up a national care service, but are starting on fair pay agreements among social care workers more immediately, that if they can hold Labour's feet to the fire over it, then that would be sort of a big win for them. And, you know, what the narrative, what the story of the party is almost secondary to sort of achievements on those particular issues. And they, I think they see themselves, the leadership anyway, see themselves as having, being able to be a sort of a critical friend of the Labour Party, that they took most of the seats from the Conservatives, so they need to keep an eye on their constituencies, where even if they won by 5,000, 10,000 votes, they, you know, they need to work those constituencies and sort of use the incumbency effect next time. So concentrate on hanging on to them, which I think is quite telling, given many of them were Tory seats. But I think with the critical friend bit of it, I think Ed Davey initially will be more of the friend until he has reason not to be. And I think probably quite quickly what we'll see is, because they don't know, like many of us, which way Labour's going to go, is Labour still pursuing the Ming Vas cautious strategy, or are we suddenly going to post-budget see something a bit more radical? Once we reach that point, post-budget, and we all have a better idea of what direction the Labour Party is going in, I think the Lib Dems won't be afraid of being more of the critic and less of the friend.
Yeah, well, and I would also say that I think it's fair to say that Keir Starmer does have a slightly authoritarian streak to him. He talks about how much he likes the nanny state, and he is Mr. Rules, of course. I wonder whether the Lib Dems are going to find space on issues such as civil liberties, where they did quite successfully under Blair, you know, things like ID cards. I imagine there'll be plenty of issues like that where they can stake out territory to the kind of liberal left of Labour. But Pippa, you are dashing back tomorrow because you are attending and taking part in a big party tomorrow night to launch our former colleague Anoushka Asthana's book, which is a big story about how Labour won the election and how the Tories lost it.
Taken as Read, it's called. Yes, that's right. I'm going to be doing a Q&A with Anoushka, our former colleague, at her book launch. And from what I've heard so far, and I've not read the whole book, but I've been sort of briefed on excerpts, it's going to be a really sort of insider account of how Labour transformed, how Keir Starmer transformed the Labour Party and took them through the election to victory. And she has had conversations with an awful lot of sort of, you know, big behind the scenes players for this book. So I think there'll be lots of really interesting insights there for us to chew over. There are various other people writing books about the election, but Anoushka's there first, so that is always, there's always an advantage to that.
One thing that so I haven't read the book either, but I did read the kind of truncated excerpts that were published over the weekend. Really interesting history about the origin, almost Keir Starmer's origin story, about how Labour together formed, and Morgan McSweeney was at the heart of that, but as were others. And one of the things she details in there is how Morgan McSweeney, who you know, has been a long-term advisor for Keir Starmer, is now head of political strategy in Number 10, how he put together a document while Corbyn was still in power about things that might get in the way of his larger project, but also things that, you know, were in his favour. One of the things that he classed as a hurdle to his moderate project was a Labour government, because he thought that a Corbyn government would actually hurt the Labour Party and hurt what he was trying to do in the long term. Now, that's quite explosive, because that is exactly what the Corbynites have always accused the moderate Labour people of doing, which was actively working against them. There has always been an argument, particularly from moderate, oh no, we didn't back Jeremy Corbyn because we didn't think he could win an election. This document suggests that Morgan McSweeney thought he could win an election and actually didn't want him to. Within Labour circles, I think that is going to be quite explosive to read.
Well, we'll look forward to reading the book and no doubt learning all sorts of other interesting nuggets about how Keir Starmer got to power. But that's all from us for now. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. John Harris is back on Thursday. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cocoutier, and the executive producer is Maz Ibtahaj. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
This is The Guardian.